Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. On today's program, a new generation of farmers is challenging our idea of what it means to work in agriculture in the Central Valley. They're bringing big city ideas and marketing savvy to small-scale farms and connecting with the nationwide interest in food culture. Can they make farming cool and hip? We'll find out in just a moment. We'll also talk with Anne-Marie Gardner, editor-in-chief of Modern Farmer, a new glossy quarterly magazine that brings a high-fashion concept to the world of agriculture. Later in the program, we'll look at the consumer side of the equation and find out what restaurants and businesses are doing to get back in touch with their food and where it comes from. That's all coming up on this special agriculture-themed Valley Edition. But first, the news.
I'm Ezra Romero with these news headlines. The California Assembly has approved a bill that would make it easier for farm workers to obtain union contracts with their employers. As Ben Adler reports from Sacramento, the measure passed Monday with the bare minimum votes needed.
The measure would require binding mediation if unions and farmers can't reach a collective bargaining agreement and give the Agriculture Labor Relations Board the power to enforce a mediator's decision. Democratic Assemblyman Adam Gray says the proposal wouldn't tilt the playing field unfairly in either direction.
This bill is about finding agreement should negotiations break down through a fair process and upholding the integrity of collective bargaining.
But growers fear the measure would stack the deck against them and mounted a heavy lobbying effort against it. Assembly Republican leader Connie Conway says she's worried about the measure's unintended consequences.
Why would you ever negotiate with an employer when you can get an amenable mediator to impose a contract?
The bill now goes back to the Senate for a final vote. At the state capitol, I'm Ben Adler.
A new survey finds half of all Californians are paying more for health care. Marianne Russ has more from Sacramento on the latest field poll.
According to the statewide survey, half of California's voters say they are paying more for health care this year than they did last year. 41% say they're paying about the same, and 5% say their costs declined. Half of those surveyed also described their health care costs as being difficult to afford. That was especially true for uninsured voters, low-income residents, people insured through Medi-Cal or the individual market, and families with children. According to the field poll, 81% of voters say Medicare is important to them and their families, while 58% said the same thing about Medi-Cal, the state's low-income health care program. The survey also asked whether Medicare is achieving its goals and found that 8 in 10 Californians think the program is successful. In Sacramento, I'm Marianne Russ.
California Governor Jerry Brown says high-speed rail is still moving forward in the state. He disputed that a court ruling last week was a setback for the project. A judge in Sacramento ruled on Friday the agency overseeing high-speed rail development failed to comply with financial and environmental restrictions placed on the project by voters. But Brown says work hasn't stopped.
As we speak, we're spending money. We're moving ahead. And I consider the high-speed rail a test of our imagination, of our political will. Is California a state that can do big things, do great things? And I think we can.
The judge declined to immediately stop funding to the project. He says he'll hold a hearing in the future to consider the issue. Work on the first phase of the rail line is slated to begin this year. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra Romero.
Local funding for FM89 comes from FM89 Broadcaster Circle, providing major gifts in support of FM89's mission.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Our program today has a special theme, the world of agriculture. I know what you're thinking. You've already heard this story. Big farms covering thousands of acres, almonds and grapes, row crops as far as the eye can see. Farmers in white pickup trucks, crews of migrant farm workers picking the harvest, and tractors nearly as big as a house. And yes, that's a big and important part of the Valley's agriculture community. After all, San Joaquin Valley farmers produced crops worth around $22 billion last year. But here in the land of big agriculture, there's also something else going on. Younger people are coming into the world of farming and bringing with them new ideas about what it means to grow food here in the Valley. They're embracing a nationwide trend, America's newfound love affair with food culture. You see it every day on television, at the farmer's market, and thousands of foodie blogs online. Heirloom tomatoes at the local store, artisanal cheeses, grass-fed beef, all with the focus on quality over quantity. And in the process, something interesting is happening. Farming is actually becoming cool. A new glossy magazine is helping to document this movement. It's called Modern Farmer. We'll talk with its editor-in-chief, Anne-Marie Gardner, in a little bit. But first, who are the modern farmers here in the San Joaquin Valley, and what do they have in common? It turns out a lot of them are what you might call boomerangs. You might even know some of them. They grew up on family farms here in the Valley, and in many cases left home to pursue other dreams. But now they're back on the farm, and they're grafting new perspectives, skills, and experiences onto traditional farming businesses. FM89's Rebecca Plevin brings us this report.
Amber Balakian grew up on a farm in Reedley. Her family grows 80 varieties of heirloom tomatoes, plus a wide variety of other fruits and vegetables.
They're loading the truck for the farmer's market. Usually they load it in the afternoon, and then they'll leave around 4 to San Francisco.
But it took her attending Harvard University's Extension School to realize that her family's business was pretty cool. She returned to the 20-acre farm after she earned her master's degree in 2009.
My main goal, like, coming back and working here was to make things more efficient. We were dumping, like, a ton of fruit, ton of vegetables.
2 years ago, she started canning her family's heirloom tomatoes, following a recipe that is similar to one her grandmother has used for decades.
You can use it for soup, sauté, pasta.
Today, her tomatoes are on the shelves of Williams-Sonoma, Dean & DeLuca, Crate & Barrel, and Sur La Table. She's been featured in Sunset Magazine and most recently, the Oprah Magazine. In the Central Valley, returning to the family farm is not a new storyline. Neither is organic farming. But what sets Balakian and several other young people apart is how they have planted their own seeds of innovation, social consciousness, technological expertise, and youthful energy on their family's farms. In the process, they might just change our views of farmers and agriculture in the region.
We are seeing a renaissance of some kind where we finally, after many years of children leaving the farm and never coming back, we have children that are actually making plans coming back to the farm.
Ryan Jacobson is the executive director of the Fresno County Farm Bureau. He's excited about this trend.
And making what I consider to be very beneficial changes, and some of them may be, you know, the inclusion of social media, trying to find some niche products that maybe typically weren't grown on these types of farms historically, and really trying to outreach to a different consumer who's looking for that different product.
Anne-Marie Gardner is the editor-in-chief and CEO of Modern Farmer magazine. She says this is a nationwide trend, spurred by a blossoming consumer interest in food, who grows it, and where it comes from.
Yeah, the farmers today are definitely changing the stereotypes, because a farmer, to be successful now, has to know about farming, but they also need to be highly technologically savvy. So farmers now have to blog, they have to do their own PR, they have to have a relationship with their customers.
Christy Bravo's parents operate KMK Farms.
We have eggplant. There's three different type eggplant. We have Japanese, American, and Italian. White onions, Armenian peppers.
After graduating from CSU Bakersfield with a degree in kinesiology, she returned to Kingsburg. She launched a community-supported agriculture business, or CSA, utilizing the organic produce grown by her family and T.D. Willie, an organic farm in Madera.
My dad didn't want me working for him hourly, so we figured out a way to make more revenue to the farm. So we sat down and created the Farmer's Daughter CSA and kind of got my own little clientele.
Most CSAs require clients to subscribe to a weekly share of produce from a local farm. The Farmer's Daughter is unique, Bravo says, because clients can select the produce they receive and determine how much they want and how often they get it. The CSA has helped link the farm's produce to local consumers. Bravo says she encourages her father to share his experiences in the fields to deepen the connections between the farm and the community.
But it's, yeah, just more getting him to know that it is a priority and customers do appreciate it. Oh, he doesn't see that quite yet, but we're working on it. Like, you know, they're picking a whole bunch of eggplant, and I'm like, snap a picture. You know, he has an iPhone, so that's good. You know, snap a picture. You know, oh, I'm too busy and to pull out the phone, you know.
About 12 miles away in Layton, 22-year-old Holly Johnson and 26-year-old Hannah Johnson sit on the porch of their farmhouse. The sisters moved to their father's farm in 2010.
I just thought it was cool to wear boots and jeans, and people think it was, like, okay to do that and not look cute all the time. Her, not so much.
I thought cowboys were cool.
Their father was 81 at the time and could no longer take care of the farm himself. So Holly took on the task of farming 50 acres of alfalfa. She also gleaned inspiration on the internet, her sister Hannah recalls.
Holly got super, like, nerdy into farming and was on Google, like, and Pinterest, pinning every single farm-related thing. And all of a sudden, I come home, and there are chickens and a chicken coop that she had built the day. Like, I left for work, and there were no chickens. And I came home, and there are chickens. And I was like, okay.
They started with 7 chickens. They named them after the 6 characters from the show Friends. The 7th, they named Willie Nelson. Today, they use social media to share their daily experiences and funny stories from their River Roots farm. They connect with people at farmers markets, where they also sell their fresh eggs called Just Got Laid. Holly explains where they got that name.
I tweeted it a long time ago. No one even responded to it. So that was lame.
I know.
But, yeah, I just thought how funny that would be. An egg company, you know, like a big egg company doing that. I would buy those eggs.
While their father farmed conventionally, the Johnson sisters are conscious of what goes on the food they grow and in their stomachs. They point to the chickens that are milling about and eating organic heirloom tomatoes grown on the farm. Holly.
I mean, I love me some double stuffed Oreos, but, you know, like, we're very aware of, like, what goes on food, especially with what we do now, what's in it and how it affects everyone's body.
Hannah.
It's the choice we made, and we're only giving products to people that we would eat ourselves.
Yeah.
Back in Reedley, Amber Balakian attributes part of her rapid success to her unique story.
And I think, like, since I'm younger and, you know, I'm not, like, your typical farmer that's, like, out there with, like, jeans, and I'm not like that, and I don't try to be like that.
She has even more creative ideas for how to utilize her family's produce. She's looked into creating a Bloody Mary mix. She's floated the idea of starting a beauty line featuring products like summer squash body souffle and heirloom tomato body scrub. She says people often tell her,
they're like, I love your product, but I love your story kind of even more. So it helps to have that story, definitely.
The same could be said for other young farmers that are cultivating a new look for their family's business and maybe the Valley's agricultural industry, too. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Plevin.
Not everybody drives a truck. Not everybody drinks sweet tea. Not everybody owns a gun and wears a ball cap, boots, and jeans. Not everybody goes to church or watches every NASCAR race. Not everybody knows the words to Ring of Fire or Amazing Grace.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. This new generation of farmers isn't something that's unique to the San Joaquin Valley. It's seen across the nation. Here to tell us more about this movement is Anne-Marie Gardner. She is the editor-in-chief of Modern Farmer Magazine, a new print quarterly that brings a high-style concept to the world of agriculture. Anne-Marie, welcome to our program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Who is the modern farmer in your definition?
My definition of the modern farmer, I think it's people that care about where their food comes from. And this can be somebody who wants to know their farmer. They maybe grow basil on their windowsill, or they sort of dream about farming. Maybe they have this romantic view of what farmers do and their lifestyle. So a modern farmer could be anybody from a third-generation farmer to a Brooklyn hipster growing basil on the windowsill, or somebody like me who's moved up to a farming area, but I've lived all around the world and I realize how much I don't know about growing my own food, and I want to know more.
Tell us a little about why you launched this magazine. A new print publication in this era is not unheard of, but it's certainly outside the norm. Food culture is such a big thing right now, but people want to know more about where their food comes from, we find. What are you finding with the way that the magazine has been received so far?
Yeah, we're finding exactly the same thing. People want to know where their food comes from. There seem to be a lot of foodie publications that are addressing the audience of the foodie, but there wasn't anything specifically looking at the sources of the food and also the lifestyle around the people growing your food and this whole, I would even call it a social life around the farmers market. So yes, I think in launching a magazine, we launched the magazine as a print publication, but also as part of a bigger digital enterprise. We look at this as the first global agriculture lifestyle brand. And so we started with a magazine because that's, we're all journalists. And I also think it's something that you can touch and feel and suddenly realize that you are interested in this, whereas maybe you didn't think you were interested in agriculture. I have had a lot of people tell me that. I didn't really know that I was interested in farming until I read this magazine.
You mentioned your own personal story and coming from an urban environment and now doing this publication, moving to upstate New York and a more rural setting. Tell me a little more about how that informs your approach to covering these issues and how you're trying to tell the story, which is a very disparate story. A lot of different sorts of people, as you mentioned, from the Brooklyn hipster to the third generation farmer. How does your experience and that of your team inform that?
Well, I would say that the way that we inform this reader, because we're not agriculture experts, and it's exactly, we're generalist journalists and even culture journalists, so we're looking at it from those eyes. We're not looking at it from the eyes of experts, but from the eyes of, gosh, we all need to know more about this. And we're going to the experts to tell the stories. And I feel in a way we're also celebrating farmers because we admire them and we think, gosh, look at what you do. It's kind of incredible. You know, I would say that a lot of people I meet in the cities can't even drive a stick shift, right? So even driving a tractor is something so many people that I know wish they knew how to do. So there are elements of this lifestyle, I think, that personally that I admire because I live near a lot of farmers. And also my team, it feels like the more we learn about this sort of whole world of food production and all the nuances involved, you know, and we all eat, and we think, how didn't we know about this before? So there's just so much more to learn. So I think we have, there's just so much material.
In the process of putting together today's program, one of the things that we've looked at as an editorial team is, what exactly are we talking about? Who are these people? Who are these modern farmers, these alt farmers, whatever you want to call them? Organic is not new. Community-supported agriculture, that's not new. But there does seem to be something happening. There does seem to be a thing that's going on. And one of the things that we've talked about, is this a youth thing? Is it multi-generational? Is it multi-ethnic? What are you seeing along those lines? And how does this differ from the legacy? Because in some ways, this is a throwback to how our grandparents' grandparents farmed and approached food and agriculture.
Yeah, exactly. And I think maybe it's taken the generations to get around again and realize what was lost because, you know, we all grew up in that era of sort of more of an industrial agriculture where we all became so removed from our food supply, right? And so there's a bit of nostalgia attached to going back to the land. And so I think I agree with you, there is a thing going on, and it's multi-ethnic, it's multi-generational. I mean, you have baby boomers that can afford to shop in Whole Foods, and they want to buy the best, you know, purest food, but you have now kids graduating high school and college that want to go woof on farms. Like, I think maybe before they would go and intern in an investment bank, and now they want to go and work on a farm in Australia and learn how to farm. And, you know, and there are all kinds of programs now that are offering farm schools. We actually have a story on farm schools in the next issue.
Speaking of the next issue, I understand your second edition is hitting newsstands September 10th. Obviously, a lot of features on the website throughout then. Tell us about some of the stories that you're most proud of that you've been working on from your launch to now.
Well, I think one of the stories that I would say in the first issue that I was very proud of, because I think it stemmed from exactly the kind of questions I was having and the conversations I was finding around the world, is everywhere I would go, people would talk about, do you eat meat? And, you know, do you feel bad about it? You know, you think about how it's killed. Is it humanely raised? And, you know, I know that was a bit of a tough story. It was a tough story for me because I grapple with those issues because I'm such an animal lover. And I wanted to make the decision for myself. If I knew exactly what happened and they didn't suffer, and what does that mean, not suffering? And how do you then make a decision, with a personal decision, whether you're going to eat meat or not? And this is something I think a lot of people struggle with, because, you know, people don't want to know that part, the slaughter process. And I feel that I definitely shut my eyes to all those videos. And so it's about just being brave enough to sort of inform yourself. And I guess I'm happy about the tone we took with that piece, because it was like we sent one reporter up to see at the most humane slaughterhouse how does it work. You know, so we're not preaching. We're not trying to give you a solution. It's not, you know, it's just to get the information out there so you can make a decision. And I feel that that was a great story. And then I think one of the funny stories that we had in was about how the wild boars are taking over the world, right? And we had so much interest in that story because we had pictures of these wild boars walking across the street in Berlin. And so it was the kind of story that everybody said, I never knew I had to even care about wild pigs, right? And now suddenly it's relevant. And both of those stories make the points I'm trying to make, is maybe this is something we're all talking about, we're thinking about, regarding where our food comes from, right? And then the other story is like, oh gosh, agriculture and these issues are really relevant to me. So if you can make the news, deliver it in a way that's really, I don't want to say always fun, but informative, in a beautiful way, in a stylish way, that's one of the big goals of Modern Farmer, that we provide this information in a very approachable way.
If you just joined us today on Valley Edition, our guest is Anne-Marie Gardner. She is the editor-in-chief of a new glossy quarterly publication called Modern Farmer Magazine. It's also a website, and they have a number of other things online. And their second edition hits newsstands September 10th. We're talking about what it means to be a modern farmer in today's world, about how farmers are challenging stereotypes of what they're doing. We're also seeing a lot of farmers really taking... I've heard this term, rurbanism, fusing elements from the urban experience and the rural experience together. What are your thoughts on that? Is that a real thing, or is that just the world that we live in today with, as you said, Twitter and Instagram meeting the farm?
Oh, gosh, yeah. I'm a big fan of the word rurbanism, and we've even made a takeoff of that word, and we call one of our design pages the Rurbanista. Okay, I think this is a really important shift that's happening, because first of all, you have this influx of farmers markets in urban areas, right? And that conversation now between the rural and the urban is being had at these farmers markets, right? But I also think that because you have a lot of urban people moving to a rural area, they're doing it with style. And so I love the idea that, you know, you have suddenly this Rurbanista fashion coming out of this, and design and style, and like there is a style involved, there's an approach, and it's these local furniture makers, and it's the muck boot, and it's, you know, the right muck boot, not just the muck boot, and you have the pointer barn jacket, you know, and there are a lot of fantastic elements in these very chic Japanese tools. People want to do it in a beautiful way, and I think this lifestyle aspect to sort of that moment of meeting the rural and the urban, to me it feels a little bit like the approach that maybe Finland takes as a country in their design sense. It's so every single person can have that beautifully designed teapot, right? So it's sort of like this beautiful style for the country now, and everybody can do it with style, and they can make these beautiful beds and beautiful gardens. I think there's really, this is going to be an element to watch. One of the things that architects are telling me right now is they all want to design like the future barn. And I think this is an area that we should all be watching out for. There's going to be some really interesting innovation, I think, around barns.
Anytime we talk about style, anytime we talk about what's cool, it brings up another question, and that's something that I've heard from people, some especially who might be more involved in the corporate agriculture world, say, this is just a fad, these are just hipsters who are into this. Does this have staying power?
Yeah, I know. We were criticized when we first came out that we were just a hipster publication, and then once everybody read it, I think they realized really quickly it had staying power, because the content is not hipster content. This is content that's relevant to everybody, whether you're a hipster or whether you're 90, right? So, you know, I've heard the same thing, and I'm not worried that this is a hipster fad, because everybody needs to care more and more about where their food comes from.
Your magazine largely focuses on the smaller farmer, the more boutique grower. Here in Central California, small farmers have been part of this community for well over a century, but this is also home to corporate agriculture, big-scale agribusiness. How do you see this movement, this modern farmer movement, coexisting with farming on a much larger scale? Can they coexist? Can they both succeed and thrive?
Well, I do think that these two parts can coexist. You've got big ag and you've got this newer, smaller farmer. Number one, the smaller farm can exist just because consumers are demanding it so much, right? And I also think that in the larger scheme of things, that big agriculture has something to teach a smaller farmer, maybe about efficiencies of scale, and small farmers can teach larger farms maybe about more sustainable methods. So, I mean, ideally, this would be the way to start a conversation between two so both can coexist. But I always do think that the small farmer will survive in this because the consumers demand it right now. And that's where the drive of this movement is happening.
We've been talking with Anne-Marie Gardner. She is the editor-in-chief of Modern Farmer magazine, a new print quarterly that brings a high-style concept to the world of agriculture. The new issue hits newsstands September 10th. You can find it at Whole Foods and other retailers. Anne-Marie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me. It was great to talk to you, Joe.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment, and we'll take a trip to a goat farm in Toll House, where a couple of farmers are growing goats for their mohair that's sold around the world. We'll also talk to some local agriculture experts here in the Valley, and we'll find out more about the farm-to-fork movement. That's all coming up next here on Valley Edition.
We can go slow or make it go faster, down through the woods and out to the pasture. Long as I'm with you, it really don't matter.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. When it comes to modern farmers, the concept isn't limited to those who grow our produce. Ranchers and those in the dairy industry are also part of the movement as well. It even extends to those who raise animals not for food, but for fiber, like Toll House resident Alan Mesick. An East Coast native, Mesick has staked his claim in Central California with a unique niche, raising goats for mohair, which he sells worldwide, together with his partner Randy Schumacher. FM89's Rebecca Plevin took a visit to the Eureka Mohair Farm in the Fresno County foothills and brings us this audio postcard.
We raise natural colored and white Angora goats. Most of the goats in here are natural colored, even though they look probably all brown or black. There's just a white one over there that's dirty. Everything sticks to the Angora goat fleece. We are a small Angora goat farm. When we have kids are the, you know, babies, we probably have at max around 75. In the fall, when we kind of select which ones we're going to keep and which ones we'll sell, we winter probably 50 or 60. We actually can go in the pen here. So this is my favorite yearling buck. His name is Tyrion. We named all of our goats last year after the Game of Thrones. And he's very friendly because last year his mom rejected him and she didn't want him, so we had to bottle feed him every day, twice a day. So that's why he's a big baby. He thinks he's a human. Oftentimes when we do displays at fairs, they say, what are these animals here? Are they sheep? And they say, no, they're Angora goats. And they go, oh, that's where Angora comes from. No, actually, Angora wool comes from Angora rabbit, mm-hmm. and it's really soft. Mohair comes from the Angora goat. Angora as a collective term refers to Ankara, Turkey, where they say, I don't know if it's true or not, nobody's ever proved it, that the Angora goat and the Angora rabbit originated. And in Arabic, mohair means select. So for thousands of years, mohair has been selected and coveted for its fineness, for its natural luster, for its ability to accept dye, and also for its softness and strength. The softer the hair, softer the mohair, the more valuable it is. In the 60s and 70s, mohair had its peak commercially, and people wore it. And there's an Elton John song, Benny and the Jets, and one of the lyrics is mohair suit. And at that time, mohair was something that was trendy and beautiful and relatively inexpensive. But feed costs, gas, and synthetic fibers have thus replaced these natural fibers. So to find a mohair suit in Macy's, for example, might be rather difficult. So our Angora goats in the morning get an alfalfa and grass hay mix. Hay is really expensive right now, but it's essential to keeping healthy goats. Our goal is to produce an Angora goat that for many years produces a soft, fine fleece. You can't sell mohair that's coarse. If you wouldn't want it next to your skin, nobody else would either. Nobody's going to buy it. I wish everybody wore more mohair because we'd all have a better business. I've had an Etsy shop for 2 years, 2 or 3 years, and we sell mohair all over the world, mostly colored mohair, to people that are either going to spin it and make yarn or people that are going to make doll hair. People want to have a connection with where their food is coming from. And I think the same applies to what they're wearing. They want to know where it came from. They want to have a connection with the animal, with the farmer, with the producer. So Etsy and small, you know, online shops like that have allowed us to reach out and get these products to people that really care about that. Sure, they're paying more for it, but in the end, they're really satisfied and they feel great about what they're wearing and what they're using. Mainly, I'm dealing one-on-one with the customer online, and they're buying sometimes 1 ounce of fiber at a time. Sometimes I literally will sell $6 of mohair, and I'll put it in an envelope and send it to Turkey. So, but you have to be willing to do that. Right. You can't say, well, if you're not going to buy $100 worth of fleece and, you know, take up, you know, this much time, I'm not going to work with you. No, you have to cater to everybody. You have to answer to people that send you a message and go, hey, I'm looking for brown mohair with like a little bit of a taupey tip to it, and I need it to be really soft, and by the way, it needs to be super curly because I'm putting it on this doll. I've found my community to sell to. I am the only Angora goat farmer in Central California that's doing this like this. So there's nobody down in Fresno that has 3,000 goats where I have, you know, 75. It's not like the small dairy versus the big corporate dairy. It's not like that at all. In fact, I kind of like that I'm near them. I like that I'm near the valley. I like that I'm near agriculture because when I say I'm from Fresno, or from the Fresno area, and I raise Angora goats, they go, hey, that's like the ag capital of California, of the U.S., of the world. So I'm proud to be part of this area. I consider myself kind of a modern farmer. You know, it's funny, the farmers probably don't accept me as a farmer, and the city people don't accept me as a city person. So I found ways to be a farmer in a modern world. It's finding something that's rare, something that's unique, and selling it and then making money off of it. So, or trying to make money off of it. I'm certainly not rich by any means, but am I happy? Certainly.
And thanks to Rebecca Plevin for bringing us that fun audio postcard. Our conversation about modern farmers or alt farmers in the Valley continues now. We have three guests joining us in our studio today. We'd like to welcome Nikiko Masumoto, author and farmer from Del Rey, as well as Patricia Stever-Blattler from the Tulare County Farm Bureau and Nicole Schott from Rosa Brothers Milk Company in Hanford and Tulare. Welcome.
Thank you.
Good morning.
I'd like to start with you, Nikiko. When we talk about modern farmers, the magazine that we had the interview with their editor-in-chief a while ago, that kind of gives us an East Coast-centric look at agriculture. But the idea that there's this new generation of farmers coming into agriculture and doing different things, incorporating big city ideas, whether that's social media or some interesting marketing savvy, telling stories, that is something that we're seeing here in the Valley, is it not?
Absolutely. I know a couple of friends that we have ventured away and opened our eyes to environmental issues, to politics, and then come back to the farm. And I think the farm is a place where we can actually live out some of our ideas of building a better and sustainable world.
And Patricia, I'd like to turn to you. This has obviously been the ag capital of the country for so long, but now we're seeing smaller farmers are not a new thing in this part of the country. We've had small farmers for well over a century here in Central California, but we see maybe small farmers are telling their stories in a new way and are connecting with people in a new way. Do you see that in Tulare County?
Certainly do. And I think there really is a renaissance in the number of small farms that are finding their niche in the marketplace. And they have to find a niche because it is not an easy business to be profitable in. And it's not enough today to say I'm in it because it's my family's way of life or it's my heritage. It has to, at the end of the day, also make sense from a financial, you know, standpoint. And I think we really see agriculture trying to tell their story and respond to the disconnect that consumers are demanding today. Consumers are very interested in knowing a lot more about their food and where agriculture takes place. And they may have grown up next to it, but that doesn't mean they have their own true connection to it. So I think the small farm movement is really important to helping all of agriculture be better stewards of their land and connect with consumers, which at the end of the day is really a goal we all should share.
And innovation, always offering the customer something new. What are people looking for? That's such a big part of business. Agribusiness is no different than that. And I think one of the things that's interesting is you look at what, for example, Rosa Brothers with the milk that your company offers and the way that you present your products to customers. It's very interesting. And Nicole, I'd like to turn to you. How has your milk company, I walk into Vaughn's and I see the glass milk jars there sitting in the shelf, and that really stands out because as someone in, well, I'm in my mid-30s, I didn't grow up with the milkman coming to the house, but there's a certain nostalgia for something that maybe didn't even exist and hasn't existed for 50 years. How have you tapped into that, and how have your customers responded to that?
Well, our customers have responded really well to it. You know, we have different people who purchase our products for kind of different reasons. Of course, the elderly group, you know, they did have it delivered to them. They remembered the milk in the glass bottle. We have, you know, the younger people who want to know exactly where their milk comes from. And we do that because we do farm tours on the dairy in Hanford. People can come out and they see exactly where everything is coming from that we produce. And then they can come to our creamery in Tulare and they can watch the milk being bottled. They can watch the ice cream being made. And then we basically just reach out to our customers. You know, we want them to know that they can come and see where it's all done, that they know exactly where it comes from, that the milk only comes from our dairy. Noel and Roland are the two Rosa brothers that have the company. And, you know, they're third generation farmers, but they knew that they wanted to have something different that could be their own and that could be sustainable for you know, future generations to come for their own families. And so that's what made them go with the glass bottled milk.
In looking at preparing this show, our editorial team was talking about these things, and we knew there was something going on because there's all these farmers that seem to be doing something that's making farming cool in a new way. But it's kind of different to look at, well, what do these people have in common? A lot of them are, like you say, a second, third, fourth generation, and I think all of you to some degree fit that characterization, or your companies do. But there's also other things, and this is not intentional, but all of the farmers that we featured in our very first piece on this program were women, and our panel here today is all women. This is not the traditional face of Valley agriculture. How, Nikiko, have you seen the growth of women in agriculture and also younger farmers? Are they more likely to be women?
Yes, actually, I can just tell my story. When I first came home to farm after going to UC Berkeley, I Googled women in agriculture, and the very first thing that hit was a class action lawsuit against USDA for bias in loans, which was actually won. So that was 2007, and then I came back from graduate school in 2011, and the statistics have shown that women are the largest growing number of new farmers. I'm not sure why that is, but I know that my interest in farming is definitely linked to being a strong woman, to believing in feminism, and believing that women can do anything.
Patricia, what are you seeing along those lines?
Well, I'm a product of the high school FFA programs and the 4-H programs of this Great Valley. And right now, there really is a predominance of young women excelling in those agricultural pursuits. And they're recognizing that the traditional role of men in production agriculture has just exploded in probably the last 25 or 30 years. And not only have women been able to overcome a lot of barriers in the production side, but there are just so many more allied industry roles that women just do a great job filling, not only in managing organizations like the organization that I work for with the Farm Bureau, but that many of our marketing and commodity and trade associations, business advocacy organizations, and then the supply and allied industry that sells products and chemicals and crop materials, and all those allied industries are now what really helps drive agriculture, and women are excelling in those industries, and they have the right skill set. They've been willing to go off and learn their trade and take jobs both in and maybe outside the industry, and then bring that experience back to both family-run operations and those allied industries that support agriculture.
There's something else going on here, too, and we're talking about younger farmers. There's been no shortage of stories over the past 10 years or maybe even more about the aging American farmer. In fact, NPR nationally ran a story this morning from Nebraska talking about the aging farmers, and farmers aren't planning for succession and they don't have wills. They're farming well into their 70s and even beyond. But here we see a youth movement. Now, I know that aging farmers still is a concern overall and nationwide, but are we seeing something different here in the Valley or something unique here in the youth movement? Like you said, FFA is booming here in the Valley. Nicole?
I think, a lot of the younger generation, kids of the farmers that are here now, they're going to college, whereas before, maybe they didn't so much. And so they're going to college and then they're bringing back something new and a lot of times something innovative that they can bring to their family farms that the generations past didn't have the knowledge of. And so I think that we're seeing more people doing that and then, kind of breaking off into these different niche markets because they're bringing new ideas and new things and they're going out, but then they're coming back and they still want to be on the family farm. But they have new ideas, and so they can really bring something fresh to the family farm.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. It's not just farmers who are taking part of this new trend that's reshaping agriculture in the San Joaquin Valley. It's also consumers, from pop-up farm-to-fork meals with acclaimed chefs sourcing their ingredients at local farmers markets. Our relationship with our food and those who grow it is changing. And even in an area where fast food and chain restaurants are king, eating local is proving to be more than just a trend for many Valley residents. Valley Public Radio's Ezra Romero brings us this report.
Chris Shackelford is on a quest for perfect produce.
I'm kind of looking for mostly herbs, heirloom tomatoes.
He's the owner of Trellio, an upscale American restaurant in Clovis. He shops at Valley farm stands and farmers markets, like the Vineyard Farmers Market at Blackstone and Shaw in Fresno.
Kind of every day come look at everybody's stuff and then kind of make a game plan as to what looks the best and what will present the best.
He says the produce and game these small farms offer add flair and freshness to his restaurant's cuisine. Each item on Trellio's menu is labeled with the farm or ranch its ingredients come from.
For us, it gives us uniqueness. It's allowed us to really be in tune with the seasons menu-wise. We pretty much write and design our menus based on what's available at all the farmers markets that we go to.
Tomatoes are a main ingredient in much of Trellio's food, but the fleshy fruits served in the restaurant aren't picked green and aren't artificially ripened. Instead, their cherry and heirloom tomatoes are from what might seem like an unlikely source, a backyard garden near downtown Fresno.
I think my first foray into hunting down was actually Towers Urban Family Farm, in that I, I didn't expect to really buy anything. But when I got there and the product they were growing, I wasn't expecting to put a middle of downtown farmer's food on my menu.
Tower Urban Family Farms, otherwise known as TUF, got its start when 33-year-old Nolan Schmidt decided that fallow ground in urban Fresno should be used for farming.
The concept is to farm either an unused or plotted or platted land, backyards that are being used for grass and using water but not producing anything for homes that are struggling. So we can take land and put in a vegetable garden and show people that it's commercially viable to use a backyard to sell to restaurants and do a farmer's market with.
Schmidt's organic operation started off with one backyard garden in the summer of 2012, harvesting mostly tomatoes. Schmidt and his two brothers now run four backyard garden plots with over 500 tomato plants and run a weekly farm stand selling over 20 types of tomatoes, eggplant, peppers, and more.
I don't know how much. Is it all the same price?
It's $3 a pound for tomatoes and then $2 a pound. So that's $1.50 and you're at like $2 right now.
Seven restaurants in the region offer Tuff's produce on their menus.
As a farm, we're willing to cater to the smallest restaurant. You know, we'll sell by the pound or to the ounce.
That's what Leo Rios appreciates.
Can I get a cafe con leche iced, please?
He runs Cafe Corazon, a Fresno-based coffee shop known for its in-house roasting. He started serving brunch a year ago using Tuff's produce.
The Tower Urban Family Farm is maybe like 6 or 8 blocks away. When a purchase is made here, you're supporting this business, you're supporting the local community. By virtue of that, I'm able to buy this tomatoes from this farm that's also very local, and it keeps all the dollars and supports the community around us.
Rios says Cafe Corazon's brunch wouldn't be profitable if it weren't for Tuff's produce.
You're able to buy it when it's very ripe and it's from around the corner, basically. It just tastes that much better. We're not under the gun to have to, you know, purchase, you know, 3 weeks worth ahead of time or have to store it in, you know, these large quantities. We're able to order it on request and have it the next day or two.
Ryan Jacobson, the executive director of the Fresno County Farm Bureau, says small farms in the valley are becoming more and more driven by local consumers. He says a movement in the region is brewing over where food originates.
There are consumers out there that want to learn more and more about where their food comes from. And so as those consumer demands increase, there's obviously niches that exist for certain farms here in the San Joaquin Valley to be able to fill those niches and supply that information that those consumers are looking for.
And that local food trend is helping boost the bottom line for small farmers.
You're just seeing more and more small and mid-scale family farms showing up at farmers markets and more consumers interested in buying local food.
That's Gail Feenstra from the Agricultural Sustainability Institute at UC Davis. She says the sooner a product from a valley farm can meet a consumer's taste buds, the better.
And the idea is that people want to know where their food comes from, basically. They want to know that it's fresh, that it's nutritious, and they also like the idea of supporting a family farmer so that agriculture stays viable in their area.
And she says that's prompting more young people to consider careers in agriculture.
Well, one of the things that we're seeing up here at UC Davis is a lot more students that are interested in this whole area. A lot of those are going on and trying their hand at farming or going back to a family farm in some cases.
But the growing demand for boutique agricultural products isn't just benefiting local farmers. There's also dozens of value-added businesses that use locally grown food to make and market their own delicious products. Take, for example, 30-year-old Casey Pomerine from Madera County. The daughter of a fourth-generation farmer, Pomerine is gathering some of the region's best gluten-free food and selling it across the nation. Each month, subscribers get a shipment of tasty and healthy treats, which she calls the G-Free Foodie Box.
Really, the box is about my favorite stuff, the things that I and the team that works for me think are incredible.
Pomerine, who holds degrees in agriculture from both Cal Poly and Fresno State, says people from around the country crave what's growing in the valley, and many will pay top dollar for it. The August box includes natural grenadine, figs, pie crust mix, gluten-free graham crackers, and more.
The whole thing about being a G-free foodie is I don't want to eat anything that tastes bad, and I don't want to eat anything that's not got a bunch of ingredients that aren't identifiable. So those are the kind of products that foodies want, and we're finding some of that crossover.
The 3-month-old company has gone from selling 35 boxes a month to 100,
and is now being scouted for national distribution.
Order fire, grape salad, two pepper soup, second course, two chicken, one tuna, one pork.
Back at Trellio, Chris Shackelford says his goal is for 75% of each plate served to be sourced from local producers.
To be like total like farm to fork is the tuna dish, because literally almost every last single ingredient has come from somebody that has either caught it or grown it themselves. Basically the salt and pepper is the only thing in there that I can't guarantee is local.
And it's those connections between the land and the table that are keeping Trellio's doors open. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra Romero.
And you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Our guests in studio on our second part of our conversation about alt farmers in the Valley, boutique growers who are redefining Valley agriculture. We have Nikiko Masumoto from the Masumoto Family Farm in Del Rey, Nicole Schott of the Rosa Brothers Milk Company in Hanford and Tulare, and from the Tulare County Farm Bureau, Tricia Stever-Blattler, joining us today. I want to talk about now the consumer side of this and how people are getting involved. It's not just going to the restaurant or the farmer's market. They're actually coming out to your farms. Agritourism is a big thing. Nicole, I know you do farm tours and dairy tours.
Yes, we offer farm tours of the dairy, and people can come out. They have to call and make a reservation, but we do them basically on Saturdays for larger groups or school tours. We'll do them during the week, and it's about an hour of your time, and you come out. We have a full visitor center. They come in, they watch a couple of videos of the history of the family, and then a family farm video of what happens in the dairy barn and so on. Then they go outside. We have a bus called the Moomobile. They get on the bus, and the bus takes them around the whole dairy, stops all along, talks about the, you know, the freestall barns, talks about all the different kinds of feed. It talks about the milking barn, talks about, you know, all the different stuff that's on the dairy, all the equipment. Then they come back to the visitor center, and then outside there's a little calf petting area where they can pet the baby calves and brush them. There's also some photo opportunities there. And we have a simulated cow named Rosie where we have little milking contests with her. And that's always lots of fun. And then now that we do have the milk, we also do samples of our milk and ice cream as well. So it takes about an hour, but we have had a huge response to it in this last year. We've been open at the creamery since September, but the farm tours, they started prior to that to start getting people out there, and it's really taken off. We had a lot of school tours towards the end of this last school year, and it's just been great. And people, when they've seen our milk in the stores, they usually call because they want to come out and see. They want to see where it comes from.
Well, exactly. You mentioned that. They see the bottle. They see your logo. They know, oh, that's the dairy in the Central Valley that's doing this really cool thing, you know, bringing back the milkman or the milk person who's delivering the milk to the doors. You know, you're building a brand there. And Nikiko, you and your family have done a similar thing with your peaches. People across the country know, oh, Masumoto peaches. You have an identifiable brand, and that feeds into a different kind of customer allegiance, perhaps, than you might find otherwise?
We're hoping so. And what we really hope is at the heart of what we're doing is telling an authentic story about who we are, about the struggles of farming, the sweat that goes into farming and ranching. And I think that the responses that we've gotten from eaters have been beautiful. People who have been foodies in cities but never made that connection to the physical place, to the physical work. And that shifts how they experience eating. I think it makes it richer and deeper.
We've been talking primarily about farmers who are doing this new, whether you call it new or not, boutique agriculture on our program today, but there's also that other side, the value-added side, the folks who take these products and transform them into other great things, great treats, whether it's cheeses or nut mixes and things like that, or restaurants. How are you seeing the value-added component, Patricia, in Tulare County, processors, producers who are taking the bounty that we have here and also tapping into that interest in foodie culture or the food industry that is so popular right now?
We certainly see a lot of new trends in this area. It is still an underdeveloped market share, I would say. I mean, Tulare County is really home to, you know, a more traditional farming, you know, business strategy. But there is a growing and emerging area of agritourism. And I think, too, our restaurant industry is really embracing and wanting to connect with our local farmers. Farm Bureau started an event about 3 years ago. This will be our fourth year this fall, doing a Bounty of the County tasting night. It's really not a new idea, and we can't claim that we are the originator of the idea. A number of other counties are starting to have these same type of events, and other nonprofits are doing these events. But they're bringing folks out to connect with restaurants and caterers and matching up that caterer and restaurant to locally sourced products. And so we are seeing a real movement in the number of small nut shops, candy stores, stores where you can buy honeys and local preserves. And, you know, you're seeing the Rosa Brothers milk in the meat markets around Tulare County. So now you can go in and buy your local steak and your local milk and pick up a jar of honey, you know, all in your local market versus only being reliant on having choices in the really the big box market stores. And so we're really pleased to see that trend. I don't know that those relationships will feed the growing world, but they really make sense on a local level, and they help bring the foodie movement out to the rural communities, and it helps the rural communities recognize that they have a place in the game to tell their story. And I think a lot of our farmers, they just are still surprised that their story isn't so widely known. But as more and more people move into the San Joaquin Valley that did not grow up here, they're very curious, and we need to find a constructive and positive way to engage them in the dialogue and open those relationships up and not have them feel restricted.
We have a few minutes left. Before we go, I want to turn back to this idea of the modern farmer and this Modern Farmer magazine. We talked with Editor-in-Chief Anne-Marie Gardner earlier in this program, and this is a New York-based publication. They present a very fashion-forward, glamorous example of what it is like to be in agriculture, and whether that's for them, folks in Brooklyn who are growing herbs on their rooftop or backyard chickens or a multi-generation family farm, there's a certain style with which that is presented. There's a criticism of that on two fronts. Number one, that this is just a fad, that this is not really something that's staying power. It's just a bunch of hipsters who now think farming is the latest trend and they're going to ditch it after something else is cool. But number two, that it maybe doesn't really portray all of the aspects of farming and the challenges. Farming is hard work. It's not just a fashion statement. Nikiko, I know you feel strongly about this.
Yes, yes. I think there's a real danger in the over-romanticization of farming, of ranching, because what happens is people have this illusion of what it's like. And then when the real sweat, the real challenges, weather, we are eternally in a dance with something completely uncontrollable, weather. And there is heartbreak on the farm. And if you are going to build a life, sustainable farming has to include a spirit of resilience. And we're talking deep, digging deep. When you do not want to wake up at 4:15 because you've been waking up at that time for the last 3 months, but you have to pull yourself out of bed, and it is not glamorous all the time. There are certainly beautiful moments that I cherish, but I feel like there's a very big danger when we lose the whole picture.
Well, certainly so. And Nicole, you were talking about coming in this morning and there was a power outage with the thunderstorms last night.
Right.
The dairy was without power. That could have been a disaster.
Right. The dairy is without power, which we know is bad for the cows. They have to be milked. So then, you know, they're crying in the pens because they need to be milked. And then on the creamery side, you know, you have to move your milk around. You don't want it to go bad. So they were there all night, you know, moving them into reefer trucks to keep the milk cold. And, you know, so there's challenges constantly in the farming industry. And so I think that, you know, it is scary because, you know, we don't want people to realize that, oh, it's just, you know, it's a fad, it's this or that. People are up all night working. It's a 24/7 job, and it doesn't go away. You know, that's your livelihood, and you have to be there all the time. And when a problem arises, you just can't go to sleep and, you know, let it go by. You have to be there. You have to take care of it.
Patricia, I'll give you the last word on this. Overall, this new interest in food culture, in what goes on the farm, and having that connection with the farmer, it may be a hipster trend in the big city, but overall, is it beneficial for our valley growers here in raising the profile of agriculture in this area and redefining it in some degree?
Absolutely. I think that when you look at the trend, you know, having consumers understand and appreciate the trials and tribulations that go into farming and agricultural pursuits makes them a more discerning shopper and consumer at the end of the day, and it helps agriculture tell their story. We are the most overly regulated state in probably the nation when it comes to agriculture. And so if the consumer is more appreciative and aware of ag's plight, hopefully they're also making better decisions in the ballot box and in who we elect as officials in this state. So it is a win-win for ag, for consumers to know their story.
Well, certainly is an interesting story, and we'll be following agriculture in the future, I'm sure, with many more stories to come. Thank you all for joining us. We've been talking with Nicole Schott of the Rosa Brothers Milk Company in Hanford and Tulare, Patricia Stever-Blattler from the Tulare County Farm Bureau, and Nikiko Masumoto from Masumoto Family Farm in Del Rey. Thank you all for joining us on Valley Edition today. We really appreciate it. That's all for today's program. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us talk@kvpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, Valley Edition reporter and producer Ezra Romero, and reporter Rebecca Plevin, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.